Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya. Naram chaiva narottamam. Devim sarasvatim vyasam. Tato jayam udirayat. Before reciting Bhagavata and overcoming sin, I worship Lord Narayan and his transcendental twin, along with Mother Sarasvati, Queen of Education, as well as Sri Vyas, who first compiled the whole narration. Nasta praishu abhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata sevaya. Bhagavatir uttama shloke. Bhaktir bhavati naishtiki. A daily class in Bhagavata and service to the pure will nurse the ailing heart until it grows completely cured. By simply hearing topics of Lord Krishna every day, your dormant love for him will thrive and never go away. So we're going to start reading from Kalakanta Prabhu's Pastimes of the Supreme Person on page 84. Sorry.
Personified religion, in your awe-inspiring way, you do not fault this man who has abused you here today. And yet your troubles aren't explained by such philosophy, for God himself alone controls a person's destiny. The Kali Age's influence has broken your three limbs. First of them, austerity, succumbed to prideful whims. Another leg, compassion, fell to gross intoxication. Your other leg of cleanliness was lost to fornication. Upheld by one remaining leg, you somehow hobble on. That final leg is truthfulness. It too is almost gone. For Kali Age proliferates in lying and deceit. When truth collapses, Kali Age's triumph is complete. Lord Krishna, with assistance from devoted pious souls, had recently exalted earth and eased her heavy load. Alone now as a cow, she worries teardrops in her eyes.
King Vishnurat studied Kali, though a bit, thought a bit, and said, I grant you life where couples join illicitly in bed. And you may also live where men drink liquor in the street, make wages, and kill animals to dine upon their meat.
Now Kali was quite clever, and he very clearly knew that no such place existed under Vishnurada's rule. He said, "Thank you, my king. If my request is not too bold, please also let me live wherever men are hoarding gold."
The gathering of gold creates a tainted atmosphere where liquor, meat, illicit sex, and gambling appear.
King Vishnurata sheltered Kali in a clever way. For he began to gather all his kingdom's gold that day. He used the funds to put together Diamond's broken limbs and brought the earth contentment so she flourished once again.
For how can there be honesty when gambling is allowed? And how can there be mercy among those who slaughter cows? Can prostitute be clean or can drunk be self-controlled? King Vishnurath stopped all this by proper use of gold.
Enlightened sages, you are here by Vishnurada's grace for the restored religion and put Kali in his place. When kings and priests are pure, the common man is satisfied, but where there is corruption, Kali will not be denied.
Sringi curses the king. Sutta exchanges views with the sages. I wish to praise King Vishnurata, then we can resume. When Drona's son attacked, Lord Krishna saved him in the womb. He always thought of Krishna, so when it became quite clear a deadly snake would kill him, Vishnurata felt no fear.
King Vishnurata left his throne and sat with Sukadeva to hear about Lord Krishna for his 7 final days. Those people who can hear and think of Krishna always thrive and risk no misconception when the time of the death arrives.
The Kali Age is powerful and eager to begin to saturate society with every type of sin. Through Kali Age personified appeared that the very day Lord Krishna left our planet, Vishnurat blocked his way.
While holding Kali back, King Vishnuratha felt no rage, for he knew Krishna made concessions for this. In Kali, one must act on it to reap a sin.
King Vishnurath knew that Kali frightens foolish souls, but who would not touch the people who retain their self-control? The king thus sheltered citizens like tigers, shield their cubs, by teaching them to serve Lord Krishna's lotus feet with love.
Dear sages, as you ask me, I have told you everything pertaining to Lord Krishna and the pious Pandu king. Submissive souls like you who hear the topics of the Lord attain the highest excellence a human life affords.
Narrative/Sages. The sage glanced among themselves, then answered as if one, "Dear Suta, your descriptions are delightfully well done. To hear you speak of Krishna has infused our hearts with hope, while sacrificial fires only blacken us with smoke."
A moment of your presence is worth more, we all believe, than money, fame, or anything a person might achieve. For you have brought us Krishna, whom the gods cannot describe. We would love to listen on for the remainder of our lives.
So please continue speaking, for we know that there is more concerning Vishnurat and the pastimes of the Lord. Your talk surpasses anything we've ever come across. What else did you find out from the enlightened son of Vyas?
Said Suta, "All your praise makes me embarrassed, I confess, for I was born in lower caste than those whom I address. Because I served and heard from more enlightened devotees, the potency of Krishna talk has lifted even me."
Lord Krishna has no master, yet he is effortlessly claimed by one who always glorifies and sings his holy name. The gods chased after Lakshmi, seeking wealth birth after birth, yet she serves only Krishna, who seeks no reward from her.
So who else could be God but Krishna? Who else can compete? The Ganga's waters purify because they touch his feet. A soul attached to Krishna can leave any situation and find the peace and happiness of full renunciation.
So let us speak of Krishna as completely as we can, like birds traverse the sky with all the strength at their command.
Vishnurath cursed. Once Vishnurath took his bow and arrow to the woods for sharpening his martial skill as royal hunters could. As Vishnurath chased his prey, his thirst began to rage. Just then he found the cottage of a meditating sage.
His beard and matted hair askew, the sage was deep in trance, unmindful of his royal guest and outer circumstance. With burning throat too dry for him to pause and clearly think, King Vishnurada blurted, "Have you water here to drink?" "You know our culture very well, so I need not repeat. Our host must always offer greetings, water and a seat." The sage, however, stayed in trance, completely unaware. A noble but neglected guest grew angry standing there.
Though usually quite patient, on this day, by Krishna's will, King Vishnurata took offense and wished that Brahmin ill. Deciding that the so-called trance was nothing but a fake, he garlanded the Brahmana with the body of a snake.
As Vishnurata left that place, he felt some slight remorse, but he could not see how his deed would alter history's course. At that time, in a nearby field, the sages, childish son had learned from all his playmates what the angry king had done.
The sage's son, named Sringi, said, "Like noisy dogs or crows, such kings insult the Brahmana class, who everybody knows are meant to head society. This king has grown so proud, he is like a dog who sneaks and eats some food he is not allowed."
"Since Krishna's disappearance, all these kings have been a bother. Just watch as I rebuke this man who mistreated my father." Now Sringi was quite powerful, but much too young to tell that what he would do next would suit the Kali age so well.
His eyes red hot with anger, Sringi muttered sacred words and called out to his playmates, "Now behold a Brahma's curse. If 7 days this king will die of deadly snake bird bite. If one is insult a Brahmana, such a death will serve him right."
The boy then marched to see his father, full of childish pride.
With every step, he felt more guilt, and suddenly he cried. The sound disturbed the sage's trance, and he came awake. He saw his sobbing son and felt the frigid, lifeless snake.
He tossed the snake aside and asked, "My son, why do you cry?" The boy explained the snake and how he cursed the king to die. The sage cried out, "Alas, my son, you lost your common sense and cursed a pious king for a most trivial offense."
"My son, you are inexperienced. You do not understand. A godly king protects us all. He is not some common man. The king embodies God himself. Without his guiding hand, the thieves will plunder all of us like unprotected lambs."
Possessions stolen, women raped, and people hurt or dead. If Brahmanas kill the king, these sins fall squarely on our head. The people will grow godless in their sensual escape. Ignoring Vedic social rules, they will live like dogs and apes.
Good King Vishnurat is a first-class devotee. His godliness makes him a saint among the royalty. When such a king is hot and tired, suffering from thirst, he should be given water, but instead he has been cursed.
Dear Krishna, all-pervading Lord, excuse my foolish son. His actions are just opposite of what he should have done. A Brahmin helps the king do well for everyone's sake, but Sringi cursed the monarch for a very slight mistake.
This king could free himself and take revenge where he inclined, but devotees of Krishna are by nature very kind. So even when dishonored or neglected or depressed, a king like Vishnurata doesn't feel himself distressed.
Sukadeva returns. As Vishnurat grew more guilty for his thoughtless deeds, he thought aloud, "I know my sin has placed a wicked seed of pain and karma sure to bloom and devastate my life. Lord Krishna, let me suffer, but please spare my son and wife."
A common man's transgression may be something this about. Like kings must always worship Krishna, Brahman priest and cause. So let my strength and riches burn before this Brahman's wrath, and I shall take another birth and walk a better path.
Reflecting those, the thoughtful Vishnuratra was surprised about the curse of Sringi and his forthcoming demise. "This news about my death is very welcome," thought the king. "It makes me apathetic to all ordinary things."
Okay, that's where we'll stop. So that brings us to our verse for today, which is First Canto, chapter 19, verse 4. Okay, please repeat after me. Sachintayan ittam atashri nodyata. Mune sutokto niritis tatak shakayaha. Sasarumene nachirena takshaka. Nalam prasaktasya virakti karanam. Sachintayan itam atashri nodyata. Mune sukto niritis takshakakshkayaha. Sasarumene nachirena takshaka. Nalam prasaktasya virakti karanam. Sachintayan itam atashri nodyata. Mune sukto niritis takshakakayaha. Sasarumene nachirena takshaka. Nalam pasaktasya virakti karanam. Vaishnavis? Okay, word for word. He the king. Chintayan, thinking, ittam, like this, ata, now, ashrinot, heard, yata, as Mune of the sage, Sutta Upta, uttered by the sun, Niriti, death, Takshaka, Akyaha, in relation with the snake bird, Sa, he the king, Saru, well and good, Mene, accepted, Na, not, Chirena, very long time, Takshaka, snake bird, Analam, fire, Prasaktasya, for one who is too attached, Virakti, indifference, Charanam, cause. Translation. While the king was thus repenting, he received news of his imminent death, which would be due to the bite of a snake bird, occasioned by the curse spoken by the sage's son. The king accepted this as good news, for it would be the cause of his indifference toward worldly things. Translation by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Real happiness is achieved by spiritual existence or by cessation of the repetition of birth and death. One can stop the repetition of birth and death only by going back to Godhead. In the material world, even by attaining the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, one cannot get rid of the conditions of repeated birth and death, but still we do not accept the path of attaining perfection. The path of perfection frees one from all material attachments, and thus one becomes fit to enter into the spiritual kingdom. Therefore, those who are materially poverty-stricken are better candidates than those who are materially prosperous.
Maharaja Parikshit was a great devotee of the Lord and a bona fide candidate for entering into the kingdom of God. But even though he was so, his material assets as the emperor of the world were setbacks to perfect attainment of his rightful status as one of the associates of the Lord in the spiritual sky. As a devotee of the Lord, he could understand that the cursing of the Brahmana boy, although unwise, was a blessing upon him, being the cause of detachment from worldly affairs, both political and social.
Shamika Muni also, after regretting the incident, conveyed the news to the king as a matter of duty, so that the king would be able to prepare himself to go back to Godhead. Shamika Muni sent news to the king that foolish Sringi, his son, although a powerful Brahmana boy, unfortunately had misused his spiritual powers by cursing the king unwarrantedly. The incident of the king's car landing the Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death. But since there was no way to retract the curse, the king was informed to prepare for death within a week. Both Shamika Muni and the king were self-realized souls. Shamika Muni was a mystic and Maharaj Parikshit was a devotee. Therefore, there was no difference between them in self-realization. Neither of them was afraid of meeting death. Maharaj Parikshit could have gone to the Muni to beg his pardon, but the news of imminent death was conveyed to the king with so much regret by the Muni that the king did not want to shame the Muni further by his presence there. He decided to prepare himself for his imminent death and find out the way to go back to Godhead.
The life of a human being is a chance to prepare oneself to go back to Godhead or to get rid of the material existence. The repetition of birth and death. Thus, in the system of Varnashra Dharma, every man and woman is trained for this purpose. In other words, the system of Varnashram Dharma is known also as Sanatan Dharma, or the eternal.
The system of Varnashram Dharma prepares a man for going back to Godhead, and thus a householder is ordered to go to the forest as Vanaprastha to acquire complete knowledge and then to take sannyas prior to his inevitable death. Parikshit Maharaj was fortunate to get 7 days' notice to meet his inevitable death, but for the common man there is no definite notice. Although death is inevitable for all, foolish men forget this sure fact of death and neglect the duty of preparing themselves for going back. they spoil their lives in animal propensities to eat, drink, be merry and enjoy. Such an irresponsible life is adopted by the people in the age of Kali because of a sinful desire to condemn Brahmanical culture, God consciousness and cow protection for which the state is responsible. The state must employ revenue to advance these three items and thus educate the populace to prepare for death. The state which does so is the real welfare state. The state of India should better follow the examples of Maharaj Parikshit, the ideal executive head, than to imitate other materialistic states which have no idea of the kingdom of Godhead, the ultimate goal of human life. Deterioration of the ideals of Indian civilization has brought about the deterioration of civic life, not only in India but also abroad.
Very good. So again, while the king was thus repenting, he received news of his imminent death, which would be due to the bite of a snake bird occasioned by the curse spoken by the sage's son. The king accepted this as good news, for it would be the cause of his indifference toward worldly things. So lots of reading. So we are about to finish this first canto of the Bhagavatam. And yesterday's class, we were discussing this occasion when Maharaj Parikshit is on tour of the empire. And he comes across Kali, who is beating a cow. And this is unheard of. And it marks the beginning of the age of Kali. So just to remind everyone, there's a difference between Kali and Kali. So Kali is the short A, and Kali is a long A. So, of course, there's a person responsible for everything in this universe, and thus there's actually a person who personifies Kali Yuga, and that's Kali, not to be confused with Kali, also known as Durga, the goddess of material, the manager of material affairs. So Kali is caught beating a cow, and of course it's described that the cow is standing on one leg, whatever that is supposed to look like. But of course we discussed then the four pillars of spiritual life and how in Kali Yuga truthfulness is the only pillar that's somewhat standing. And where we go today with the rest of these next two chapters is that, again, Bhumi offers her prayers and glorifies Lord Krishna. And the sages then glorify the recitation of this. Again, if you remember way back, the sages, when they gathered, one of their first questions was, please describe to us the activities of Krishna's appearance on this planet. How can we understand his activities? And so this is part of Shukadev Goswami's, rather Suta Goswami's response. So he's explaining these pastimes of Krishna. So the pastimes of Krishna have been summarized, and now we're moving on to a new section, which is describing the actual conversation between Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadev Goswami on the bank of the Ganges River. So, the story goes is that Maharaj Parikshit is, as a king is allowed to do, he was hunting. And although it's interesting, you see the demise of so many kings when they're after a hunting expedition. So it's interesting, it's allowed, it's part of the Kshatriya Dharma, but you see so many great kings curse. Of course, we heard about Pandu yesterday, his curse when he shot Manishat, the mating deer, and Shantanu, of course, was cursed, and you know, so we see so many. Anyways, so Parikshit is hunting, and he's famished. He becomes suddenly very thirsty, and he comes across a small hermitage, and there's a sage meditating. And so it's described that this was actually Krishna's arrangement. Maharaj Parikshit wasn't actually that malicious. That because when he entered this hermitage, the sage didn't get up from his meditation and immediately see to his needs and receive him as one properly should for a king of the empire. But of course, by Krishna's arrangement, he got extremely angry. So here's a sage, he's meditating. And of course, this is the king of the empire. Of course, if President Obama had walked into the room, we would see to his need. That's just the nature. So not only is that the code of civilized culture, hospitality, but very much so for a great king. So the sage was meditating, and he, as far as I can understand, he didn't recognize that Maharaj Parikshit had come into his hermitage and that he was there. But regardless, Maharaj Parikshit got very upset. He was very thirsty, so thirsty. And so he conveniently found a dead snake and placed it around the neck of the sage and left. Now, it's described that immediately after he leaves, he's feeling some sort of remorse. Maybe that was a little bit of an excessive reaction. And so he's immediately feeling a little bit of guilt. But in the meantime, the sage's son comes, Sringi. And so this is a young Brahmana boy. And he sees that there's the snake garlanded around his father's neck. And he becomes enraged. Who has done this to my father? And he, being a young, immature Brahmana, decides to curse Maharaj Parikshit for this wrongdoing. Now, when the sage comes out of his trance, out of his meditation, it's described that he's a great mystic yogi, he casually tosses a snake off of his neck, not thinking anything of it, and soon learns about the curse that his son has placed on Maharaj Parikshit. And he's outraged. He explains to his son that this is not the proper application, that in actuality Maharaj Parikshit is our protector, and that it's the Brahmin's duty to serve the king, because the king takes care of everyone in the kingdom. So it's part of Brahminical culture to counsel and see to the well-being of the administrative class, and what to speak of the emperor. So he's absolutely aghast. His son has just cursed Maharaj Parikshit, this Mahabhagavata, to die in 7 days. So the boy curses Maharaj Parikshit that he will die in 7 days by the bite of a snake bird. And when a messenger is sent to Maharaj Parikshit, this is Maharaj Parikshit's response. He takes it in stride, and you know, he says that this is actually a benediction. This is good news, because it'll be the cause of my indifference toward worldly things. And so that's the topic of today's class, is helpful indifference. So we'll just quickly go through the purport and then discuss. Sorry. And then discuss. Thank you. this idea of helpful indifference. Okay. Is that, Kalakantra, was that as far as you wanted me to go in the story? Did you want me to go to the end? Okay. Okay. So in Prabhupada's purport, one of the first things he talks about is real happiness. Real happiness is achieved by spiritual existence, he says. So we all know the verse in chapter 8 of Bhagavad Gita, A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punar Avartino Loka. Oh, excuse me, Punar Avartino Arjuna. Mam Upetya Tu Kaunteya Punar Janma Navidyate. So from the highest planet in the material world to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death takes place. But one who attains my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So we know that within the material world, happiness is limited. Of course, there's a spectrum, and we know that in the higher planets, there's more capacity for enjoyment. But ultimately, the happiness of this material world is but a drop of the ocean of the happiness derived from spiritual existence. So Prabhupada continues to talk about what I call spiritual fitness, and he describes how material wealth can be an obstacle to spiritual life. We're going to finish Bhagavad Gita chapter 3 already in our evening class. And there was an interesting purport in the first chapter, verse 19, where Prabhupada talks about, he says, a sincere devotee wants to satisfy the desires of the Lord, he can. Since a devotee wants to satisfy the desires of the Lord, he can, Lord willing, accept all kinds of opulence for the service of the Lord. And if the Lord is not willing, he should accept not a farthing. Does everyone know what a farthing is? What is a farthing? An English currency? Like an old English currency? Anyways, farthing is like a penny, right? So, yes, material opulence can be a great impediment to material life because of the attachment that is derived from this idea of ownership. But the devotee sees Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam, that the Lord is the supreme controller and proprietor of all things, and therefore we are simply borrowing, we are simply lending those gifts that he has given us. And thus it's not a, I just think it's interesting there, I feel like if you study the history of religion, there's definitely many spiritual movements that have begun that emphasize the upliftment of the poor, and that the poor are actually the most worthy of salvation, or the most worthy of God's kindness or grace. And that's true in one regard. But ultimately, it's not so much of how much one has in their bank account or how much one doesn't have in their bank account. It's what they do with that. So one can be the richest person in the world and the greatest devotee if they use their wealth and opulence and offer it back to the Lord. So this concept of accepting distress as good news. So how many people accept bad news as great, great elements in their life? It happens all the time. There's always these amazing obstacles that appear out of nowhere. And this is a symptom of an advanced, spiritually advanced person, is that they see these impediments, seemingly impediments, or obstacles as actually great news, because they help us detach from the material world. or our, you know, material desires. I was in the association of a very senior devotee, and he was receiving a lot of criticism. And I was so amazed in the way in which he received this criticism. And at one point he had told me that actually he feels that this criticism is a blessing, in that it's helping him detach from the material world. It's helping him, it's helping him focus more strongly on his spiritual life and detach from unnecessary material desires. So, this is a symptom, of course, of a highly advanced spiritual person, and that brings us to this idea of Varnashram Dharma and taking this precious opportunity of our human life and really going for it. We're here, I mean, we've got so many advantages just because we're right here, right now. There's so many people in so many different conditions, and yet, by our good fortune and a little bit of our endeavor, we've made it here. We're so fortunate to be sitting in Bhagavatam class, to have the association of devotees, to be exposed to this complete philosophical system, this knowledge. There was an Indian boy yesterday who was asking me, what attracted you to Krishna consciousness? He wanted to talk to me because he felt like the Indians that were here just were here because that's what their parents taught them what to do. So he's like, I want to hear from somebody who decided on their own. Little does he know. So, Varnashram Dharma, we started talking about it yesterday in Bhagavad Gita class. So, Varnashram Dharma, of course, is the social system, the system that's designed by Krishna for the societal organization of humanity so that everyone can spiritually advance. So, of course, it's the Varnas, the four Varnas and the four Ashrams. The four Varnas are the four, what's called the social orders, and the Ashrams are the four steps or processes within your spiritual life. And it's described in the purport to chapter 2, verse 31, that there's two types of what's called svadharmas. So here's this idea of duty. So of course we know that there's four varnas, and it's really hard to figure out what your varna is in this age because we're all mixed up. And of course we know that the four varnas are Sudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, and Brahmana. Right? And so we began talking about this concept of duty. Krishna says that one should perform your duty without attachment to the results. That you have a right to perform your duty, but you don't have a right to the results, to the fruits of your labor. And so we're trying to wrap our heads around this idea of duty. What is duty? So we know that there's, what's mentioned, there's two types of svadharmas, what's known as like specific duties. So there's what we call our material duties and our spiritual duties. And then there's this idea of Sanatan Dharma, our like eternal duties. So it's like, what are we supposed to be doing? And later on at the end of this chapter, Maharaj Parikshit asks the question, what's the duty of everyone in all circumstances, and especially one at the time of death? So we'll be talking more about this concept of duty in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, but this is the great obstacle the great challenge for all of us is figuring out our duty and figuring out this balance. So sometimes we say, I have to, thanks Prabhu, but I have to take care of my material life right now, or like I have some like material things I have to figure out, and I don't have so much time for my spiritual life, or right now I just want to devote all my time to my spiritual life and not worry about my material circumstance. And that's like the great balance we're trying to figure out. And I think the advanced souls will tell you that it's tough and it's a process. And because life is always changing and your circumstances are always changing, that it's an ongoing calculation, trying to figure it out. And yet at the same time, the glorious thing about Krishna consciousness is that there doesn't really necessarily have to be any material activities, in the sense that even washing your clothes can be done in a mood of devotion. Washing your floor, brushing your teeth, all of these necessary things that have to be done can be done in a mood of devotion. Certainly maintaining our body, because it's not ours, it's Krishna's. We can take care of it for Krishna. We can maintain this temple for Gornitai. So all of these things that may appear to be material, if we have the proper consciousness, we can see that actually, no, everything's spiritualized if it's connected with Krishna. So Varnashram Dharma, I think that's another class. But basically it's understood that it's man's stepping stone for spiritual advancement, and that human civilization begins with Varnashram Dharma. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, down the road. So then last but not least, responsibilities of the government. So Prabhupada says the real welfare state must employ revenue to advance Brahminical culture, God consciousness, and cow protection. So these are the three essential, well, Prabhupada happens to remark in this purport, are essential for a good government. And so I brought up what the U.S. federal budget was for the 2009 fiscal year. And you'll be happy to know that military spending accounted for 54% of the entire budget for 2009. 54%. And of the total pie, 30% goes towards human resources, in which the education department is one section of that, which I wasn't able to get specific. There was one chart I saw, but I wasn't able to get it on time. To analyze it on time. But basically, you can see that we are totally obsessed with defending ourselves. This is, of course, oh, it's really interesting. So the U.S. military budget, or our expenditure, equaled that of, so of all the countries in the world, the U.S. employs the most amount of money into its military budget. Now the next 15 countries, the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, that come behind them, the next 15 countries fit into our budget, our military budget. So you can get an idea of the proportions of our priorities. So this is the country's priority right now is defense, right? And of course you can say, well, it's being used for the Iraqi war and to save the people of, so anyways, it's another story, but you can see where our priorities are and the amount of money. I've also heard a statistic that the amount of money that's spent on education for the entire year is equivalent to 1 day's spending of the military budget. So this is the great tragedy, is that we're totally obsessed with defending ourselves and have no emphasis towards education. And the education that is offered has little to say about the soul and has little value as far as understanding who we are, the meaning of life, what are we doing here, what's our duty, what we should be doing. So that's the tragedy. So in conclusion, this idea of helpful indifference, I didn't really get to, but I thought it was interesting. I think there's helpful indifference and then there's not so helpful indifference. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes in Harinam Chintanami that we were describing this at the Japa retreat, that of all the offenses, inattention is actually the most severe because it's the cause of all of the other offenses. And he describes that there are three types of inattention, and indifference is one of them. And so that's indifference to the holy name. And so he says, if indifference or a lack of attraction to the name is present, one should take the association of Vaishnavas who are properly chanting in some place sheltered from the material influence. By chanting in that situation, his absorption from material things will be reduced. So we have a very nice atmosphere here. So please take advantage of it. Here, there's nice association with so many devotees who are sincerely endeavoring to chant the holy name with full attention. So this is a type of indifference that we don't want. We don't want indifference to, you know, this sort of goes into the broader category of detachment and renunciation. And if you look in the Bhagavad Gita, if you go through the index, detachment and renunciation each have about 4 pages of references. So this is a huge topic because we don't really know what renounced life means. We don't know what proper indifference means. And that's why Arjuna asked Krishna, how does a self-realized person walk? How does he talk? What does he do? Because we have all these ideas of what renunciation means, and we have all these ideas of what it means to be a religious person or what it means to be detached. And yet, in our immaturity, we don't actually know what that means. I think a lot of propaganda is out there that indifference or detachment means to be grave, completely stoic, emotionless, desireless, no preference. And my experiences with the advanced devotees that I've had the fortune of association with is that they're actually quite great people, and they're actually people, and they actually have preferences, and they're actually, some of them are actually really fun. And so this idea of indifference, let us not confuse it with emotionless carelessness, detachment. Let us be mindful that indifference is actually indifference to our selfish material desires. And that is the indifference that we're striving for. And so this is the type of helpful indifference that we are seeking. And so this indifference of happiness or distress, cold or heat, these ideas, matra sparsha stukanteya. So these elements of auspiciousness and inauspiciousness will come and go. And the point is just to continue. As we've been given a process, we've been given the holy name, and our responsibility, our duty is just to continue in our endeavor. And that is the success of our life.